It's Spoiler in Time, the show where we take the hard work we've done on Cord Killers, figuring out how to watch things, and then talk about them. This week, we are going to talk about Extras, the Picard episode. We have watched the entire new first season of the new series, The Boys, on Prime Video, and we'll check in on our thoughts of the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm Tom Merritt, and this, my friends, is Brian Brushwood.
Heck yes, and as always, we're going to begin by checking in on our silly fantasy movie league, The Movie Draft.
I mean, very serious, very important.
Super silly. Just silly. Might as well flip a coin.
Probably should tie up all your self-worth in...
Welcome. Welcome to the Coin Flip Podcast.
Lion King is at $352 million, practically, after 2 weeks in the theaters, putting Team Sword and Laser in first place, Brian.
Oh, wow. What an unexpected and very boring turn. I'm teasing. I don't want to be a bad loser. Dude, congratulations. That's awesome. I almost believe you're going to win.
I believe I'm going to win.
Really?
Yes.
Tom, you're close enough. You could break a bill. If the Lion King gets over...
The Lion King will put me over a billion.
Yeah.
The question is, right now, Team Sword and Laser is $110 million in front of John Trekker. It Chapter 2 will make more than $110 million. Toy Story 4 may even bring in a couple extra million between now and then, too. So the question is, the remaining Lion King gross over the next 2 months versus the 4 weeks of It Chapter 2... domestic gross, will they match up? And I feel pretty good that Lion King can outdistance it, but we'll see.
Just as a reminder, the first It was $330 million, Chapter 1. And this has more star power, and they're already marketing it hard. So I don't know, Tom. I don't know if you've got...
$330 million, should we assume... that it makes exactly the same.
Let's just say, for simplicity, let's say 300 million.
Let's say 300. I'm already 110 up, so that means I have to make sure that The Lion King makes more than 190 million between now and the end of September.
I don't know.
That's
this one's going to be close. I think it's going to be a squeaker. I'm really excited to watch how it ends up.
I wonder if It Chapter 2 being a direct sequel will actually get less people out.
It could, and that's
how I win. Is it's mm-hmm. Oh, it's a sequel. I like the first one, but I don't know. Yeah,
but again, more star power.
Otherwise,
they're
the Lion King has to make $540 million, and I don't think it's going to make $540 million. But I also don't think that Chapter 2 is going to make $300 million. So,
W. Scott S. 1 brings up a very good point that the gross for Chapter 1 was its entire run, whereas mm-hmm. Chapter 2 only has 4 weeks. But I think, man, I think it's going to be close. I think it'll be within $20 million by the end of this.
And we only have two movies left in the draft. Team Hammerson has Fast and Furious Hobbs and Shaw coming out this weekend.
Hey, I really like the fact that they were nice enough to release the entire movie for free and to splice it up into installments and put them in front of movie theaters all summer long.
I still want to see it. I don't even care. Like it just looks so much, like so much fun to me. But yeah, we'll see. It Chapter 2 comes out September 6th.
I see you in the chat, says we all gloat down here.
That works either way. That is going to be the tag. No matter who wins this movie draft. That's amazing.
Oh, that's
all right,
good.
Let's get into talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, wow. I didn't think we were heading straight into it. Let's both write down our things, whether we liked it or didn't like it, and then reveal them.
Okay, so Brian is pantomime writing on his palm.
All right.
Putting mine on Twitter earlier last week.
Yeah. I put mine in the podcast that we did this afternoon. So I'm not making it up.
All right.
Tom, what'd you think?
I thought it was amazing. I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan. I thought it was sad. A lot of people think the ending is happy. I think the ending is sad because of the fact that it shows you what could have been. Kind of. I didn't even find it bittersweet. Like I was like, man, that sucks that Sharon Tate didn't get to have that conversation that she's having there. But overall, to me, it felt weirdly like La La Land. Not in any way similar movies, but this was a director showing his love for Hollywood. And in this case, his love for Hollywood is the 70s, the roots of things, the controversies and the murder. And it's actually probably the lightest Tarantino film I've ever seen, which could bug me, but I just had such a good time, possibly because I live here. You know, like the fantasy of being able to drive around on the freeways that easily probably sucks me in a little bit. But yeah, I liked it. What about you?
Bryce?
I walked out of the theater shaking my head because I had no idea what I was watching. I felt like it was a lot of really good scenes that I thought were really well acted and really well shot and well directed. That kind of didn't go anywhere. Now, granted, I don't know a lot of Quentin Tarantino. I've only seen a few Tarantino movies. I didn't know anything about the Manson Tate stuff going in. And so at the end of it all, I felt like, I don't know why we spent so much time to get to this one point where I might have even liked it better if they just, like, I don't know, stopped at that 6 month time jump. And I don't know, it felt like I didn't understand why we were even bothering to do this fan fiction alternate history, but it was also for something that was not memorable or important to my life. So
real quickly, when they show Cielo Drive the first time, did anyone in your theater like gasp or not, have a reaction?
Not really. I could tell it was
because,
like,
in the theater I was in, people were like, oh.
Oh, really?
Right? Yeah.
And
same thing. I was driving when we were moving into this house. I was driving here every day from the west side up to the valley. And the valley is where Brad Pitt's character lives. And I, one time, because of traffic, had to go past Cielo Drive. And I went, oh, that's Cielo Drive, like up there somewhere. That's where it happened. So it makes all the difference, I think.
Yeah. Because I thought the way they set that shot up, it's like, oh, something horrible. It's like, finally, something's going to happen in this movie. And when they actually see, it wasn't Sharon Tate's name that got my eyebrows up. It was Roman Polanski's name. It's like, oh, didn't some stuff go down with him? Is this what this movie is?
Yeah, and then that happens later in Roman Polanski's life. But
that's
yeah.
Right. So, twice upon a time in Hollywood. yeah, I don't know. I felt very unaffected by it, I guess, is a good way to sum it up. Brian?
I perfectly thread the needle between you guys. Tom, in the last 10 years, maybe 20 years, I, for the life of me, cannot remember a time that I was closer to getting up and walking out of a movie. I hated the first 80 minutes. It was Tarantino at cover your kids' ears, but if I wanted to watch a solo masturbation scene, I would have gone to Pornhub. And I didn't need to go to this theater. It was dead silent.
So this movie belongs on Cinemax.
Yes, exactly.
Cinemax Plus.
It was Tarantino at his schmaltziest, most self-aggrandizing, doing victory laps for no good goddamn reasonist, jump breaking style, establishing a pattern and then dropping it for something else shiny. We didn't need to see the Forrest Gump. What if Leonardo DiCaprio was in the Great Escape scene? None. I hated it. I hated it so much. I wanted to walk out. And then I got to the last scene. And I burst out laughing and I applauded. And it was so unexpected. It was so remarkable that I was forced to re-examine the entire movie. And I went back scene by scene, and everything I hated, I don't know that that the ending would have been as good if it weren't there. That weird ass random, hey, did you know that Brad Pitt probably could have beaten up Bruce Lee? Like, I was like, the hell are you even doing? Why is this? But in the end scene, that was important, so that they set up the credibility of him being able to grab kung fu knife stuff, right?
See, I guess that's where I have that scene was great on its own, though.
I disagree. a whole five.
Also, many of those scenes, including that one, loosely based on real life events.
Again, yeah. And if you know all of this, I'm sure it's very supporting of your theory that Hollywood is important and that Hollywood is a magical place. A whole 5 minute scene with Brad Pitt staring at his dog with over-the-top gross sounds. Did you guys notice that all of the sound foley, and maybe this was an intentional thing, was over-the-top? Like, every light bulb had to sound like a freaking Tesla coil. Every soup had to be slurped. They stick their finger in...
That's the period-appropriate style, right?
But and also, I think all cinema does that. I mean, we were talking off the stream.
Yes, some do it well and subtle, where you lose yourself in the story. Mm-hmm. Some do it gross, that makes it uncomfortable and make you want to get out, get up and leave.
And some people go, oh, I totally get this is what 70s movies, this is even Taxi Driver feels this way. And some people go, yeah, but I don't like that. And that's Brian.
So here, let me explain the difference between your perspective, Tom, and Bryce's. It is the equivalent of a magic trick.
Yes, tell us what we think, Brian.
No. Do not mischaracterize. That's not fair.
Okay.
It is the equivalent of a magician revealing the five of diamonds, but you didn't know that was their picked card. Or even better, imagine going. It's an Andy Kaufman bit. It is Andy Kaufman did that bit where it was nothing but a terrible, terrible stand-up routine. All of the laughter was nervous laughter. And then he moves into impressions, and the impressions are all universally awful. And he's like, well, I got one more. It's this guy. And then he does the most amazing Elvis impression ever. Now, if you've never heard of Elvis, then you're like, what the hell was that? That was really bad all around, but I guess that was a fine dance at the end. But if you know who Elvis is, you realize that you've been taken for a ride. After that highly unpleasant first 80%, you realize you've been taken for a ride this entire time, and it's a very satisfying ending. That is what I felt.
That's actually the difference between Bryce and your perspective, not mine.
Because I did not have
an unpleasant time for 80 minutes.
Correct. Yes. That is a good point. I understand a big part of why we got everything we did, but man, that was a heavy toll for a hell of a payoff to that gag.
That's not how I viewed the movie. I viewed the movie as a series of vignettes, similar to Bryce, that were enjoyable, that were beautiful, nice little nods. I actually followed the story of, I can never remember those two guys' names, but Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
I followed
the story and enjoyed it. I liked the story of their friendship. I liked that it wasn't like a typical like, oh, they hate each other, but they like each other. Because the real life story that's based on is Burt Reynolds and his stuntman. They actually kind of hated each other, but also liked each other. And in this one is like, yeah, but what if they didn't? What if they actually got along? And what if when Burt Reynolds screws him over, the other guy's like, man, you know what? I kind of knew that was a scorpion when I brought him on my back. And that's what that story felt like. And then elevated by having the amazing, magical Fantasyland ending for Sharon Tate at the end.
Yeah, also I'm glad that you brought up La La Land, because, hey, Tom, you know what does well at the Oscars? His movies that celebrate acting in Hollywood. You think this one will...
You know, what's interesting about this is Tarantino isn't glorifying Hollywood in this, and Tarantino generally never glorifies anything. Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, all that stuff, right? But it's not... I would hesitate to say whitewashed, but pretty close, because it doesn't go into the underbelly. The underbelly is all kind of taken up by the Manson murder story. So in a way, this is Tarantino's best shot ever, because if he's not trying to tell that Sharon Tate story, then I think he diverts himself into showing a lot of the slimy underworld of Hollywood. And the worst thing you got is Al Pacino's character coming in and being kind of sleazy, right? It's not that bad.
And I think
because he's like, well, I got to save all the blood and gore and the horribleness for the Manson family.
Yeah. And that diversion. So again, that was one of those, you know, that plotting minute by minute countdown. You're like, we get it. She's going to die. Ah, would you just get it over with? And then gotcha. Like, I mean, they got me good. They got me really, really good.
As soon as he went out for a walk with the dog, I'm like, this is not going to go down like history. Because, I mean, obviously, a guy could have been out walking his dog when Sharon Tate was murdered. That's quite possible. Obviously, that person never saw anything weird, right? But we've spent so much time introducing him to the Manson family out at the ranch. And you don't say, here I go with my dog, if you're not going to pay that off somehow. I was like, this is going to end up with him, I thought, saving Sharon Tate. But instead, they actually surprised me even more by not even ending up going to Sharon Tate's house at all.
There was one moment that I did feel the thing you felt, because I could tell that they were making a million references and wedging in, you know, remember this? Were you alive for that? Have you heard of this thing? They're all there. And in general, I found it all eye-rolling and painful and unnecessary. There was one moment that it happened to be the thing that I recognized, which is there's a passing car playing, I believe it's an ad, with the unmistakable voice of Ken Nordine, the spoken word poet who did the Colors album and the advertisements for all this stuff. That was the one moment I'm like, all right, that was okay. That's pretty good. Ken Nordine's pretty cool.
And that makes all the difference, yes. Right? It's not just the Tate stuff, too, which I think explains Bryce's reaction perfectly. But there's also like every song Tarantino picked, I'm like, oh yeah, no, this song. I played this song on AOR radio. Like that's a good pull. That's a good pick. But that's meaningful to me. It's meaningful to Tarantino, who's a nerd about that sort of stuff. If you're not caring about that stuff, if you're not into it, you're like, oh, I guess that's an interesting song. You know, like I kind of know it, right? And there are a million other moments that are lost on me that are like, you know, people who are way into films of that period are seeing like, oh, that's that. Oh, that's cool. That's that. Which are just, that's layered on top of it. So
this
your
really...
mileage will vary on this movie for sure, depending on what you bring into it. I was stupid, lucky enough to read a Variety article while I'm sitting at the bar before I went in to watch it, that explained like, these are 10 movies you need to watch before you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I'd seen a good percentage of them. And I'm like, oh, okay. So the Smokey and the Bandit thing, that's going to be, you know, and I was primed going in. I think that makes a difference too.
Yeah. I just realized this movie is Quentin Tarantino's Forrest Gump. And I hated Forrest Gump because it relied so heavily on that. Remember JFK? Here's a CG thing of Forrest Gump wedged in next to him. I think that's what I was viscerally, angrily like, yeah, I get it. I get what you're doing. And I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
Because I liked Forrest Gump at the time when it came out, because I'm like, oh, I get all these references, right? Nowadays, when I look at Forrest Gump, I'm like, yeah, but you could have done a cooler reference. Like, that's the obvious one. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is Quentin Tarantino's Forrest Gump in the sense that he's like, my references are way cooler. Check this out.
I'm Squeaky sure they frown. Are. Huh? Yeah. But yeah. Oh, man. I'm so glad that I got to that source of my frustration.
Well, good. Let's move on to something that I don't think any of us found frustrating in whole anyway. The Boys, season one, which, as I mentioned on Cord Killers, Eileen suggested that we check out, and I'd forgotten was out this weekend and was like, okay. So I texted Friday after we watched the first couple episodes. And then again, as we mentioned on Cord Killers, all three of us started texting out of sync in watching, not sure if we were spoiling each other, and we all made it all the way through, huh?
Yeah. All in the weekend. And I did not expect, that's what, eight or 10 1-hour episodes.
Eight.
Yeah. I loved it more and more as we went forward. My wife couldn't get on the ride because of those brief, very graphic, gory moments. But I feel like those were so necessary, along with the, you know, the opening sexual harassment abuse in the very opening scene. It had to start off so dark at the beginning to earn those moments of levity that really resonated with me. And I found it fascinating just to follow one thread. I'm pretty certain that the Deep is represented as purely awful in the first episode. And every single moment after that, he's only represented as more likable, more appreciable, more
sympathetic. If not likable.
Yeah. Maybe not like likable.
Oh no, I mean he's downright likable at times. Are you kidding me?
when he's in Sandusky, he starts to be. Yeah.
Yeah, or trying to do the right thing, rescuing a dolphin or whatever. Like that dolphin scene.
Dumb when he's rescuing the dolphin.
I know, but very well meaning. He's really trying.
To his own goal. Like it's not like he's trying to make up for anybody.
No, that would be awful. Then it would have no. He's doing it literally for himself because he thinks it's the right thing to do, which is the most honorable reason to do it, is because it's just the right thing. He's not doing it to impress anyone.
This is out of sync, but it ties into the idea of like character arcs for the members of the Seven. I loved that Black Noir isn't involved. And in fact, at one point, Homelander calls him out and is like, except for you, you're great, right? Like, let's just have one character that's just like above it all, but therefore is not involved in the story. And then he comes in and shoves a guy off the piano and starts playing piano. And I'm like, oh, this is it. This is where we finally get Black Noir in the story. Nope.
Just a cool guy playing piano.
He just wanted to play piano. That's all. Yeah. Nothing to it. Carry on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the interplay, the confliction, the fact that we're so on board when we see the murder of Translucent and then become increasingly less on board. I mean, I think that's what this is a game of. It's the Shield. It reminds me of that thing for the Shield. The first episode of the Shield, you see Vic Mackey and you're like, this person's irredeemable. He's damned from the very beginning. I'll never like him. I'll never be on his side. I'll never perceive him as the hero. And then that changes. And likewise, you know, that goes both directions from who we think are the heroes and who we think are the villains.
Yeah. Exactly. Because Homelander, I was convinced that like, oh, he's the one guy that they're all going to lie to because he's the good superhero. What it turns out to be quite the opposite.
I feel like I never really got a good grasp on the boys as a crew. I couldn't tell if they were supposed to be the super villain crew or if they were how righteous they really were. I mean, I get that there's a hero anti-hero sort of element to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely
felt vigilantes.
Like vigilantes. Yeah. But they want to work
the way superheroes are. They're working outside of the established system to serve a higher sense of justice.
But they also want to work with the CIA. I think it was between that and like not really getting much about Billy Butcher until you know the very end, where I was like, is he going to also have powers? And I was just confused about that conflict.
I always interpreted Billy Butcher as he's the rogue cop who plays by his own rules, dialed up to 12. Right. He's so rogue. He's not actually a cop. He so plays by his own rules that he doesn't have anyone enforcing rules on him.
Well,
like, let's just make him that character to the extreme.
I got to tell you, it wasn't until maybe episode 3 that I started to relax on the idea that he was definitely the mastermind supervillain and would be revealed to be so. So that's, you know, he begins off by lying to the guy and then Billy Butcher. Yeah. Billy Butcher. Not until maybe episode 6 that it's like. Well, it seems like it's highly unlikely that they'll suddenly turn around. And I mean, and, you know, finally it's like episode 7. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I think he's exactly who he seems to be at this point. Like with 80% of the show.
That's the brilliance of the series is that he was who he seemed to be all the way through, but you were never comfortable with that. Because I was actually with you, Bryce. Early on, I was like, maybe he has powers and he's holding them back.
Yeah. That was just like a real confusing thing. Like, I didn't. Could you guys answer this? Do they want to just kill the superheroes? Do they want to get rid of all the superheroes? Is this all revenge?
I mean,
it's certainly something that Huey is struggling with once they go to
the CIA. I think they want to. Certainly, Huey wants to get vengeance on A-Train. He wants A-Train in jail. And the way to that is the Compound V. And so, therefore, he wants to expose them and get rid of the bad ones. But obviously, he believes in Starlight. And never doesn't believe in her as a good force. He has to convince her. So I don't think he wants to kill all superheroes. And I don't think Billy Butcher wants to kill all superheroes. He wants Homelander to pay for what Homelander did to his wife.
Well, I think he does want to kill Homelander, knows that that's not on the menu, but he's still very hungry and he'll take what he can get.
Whatever can get him closer to that goal, sure. Yeah, if he can get rid of a few other assholes along the way, the great, because he knows they're all assholes, at least in his mind they are. But yeah, I don't think he wants to kill all superheroes. He just wants to do whatever gets him close to his goal of getting Homelander to the point of where he throws it all in if she won't include Homelander on the list of targets.
Yeah.
Homelander Oof, that's a dark individual. That plane scene. Wow. The only thing, and okay, the same thing that annoyed me about a certain other movie that we just talked about. There was one moment of that annoyed me in The Boys when he gets up to make a speech at the wreckage of the flight, and it's like, oh, I get it. He's doing the President Bush 9/11 thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, quote for quotes. And then they literally like they're like, oh, that one line is definitely a reference, and the next line, and the response from the crowd. And his response to the response for the crowd. I'm like, come on, guys.
They did that twice.
Yeah, yes.
He did it in another place, too. I think maybe at the rally. I can't remember for sure.
Yeah, that was a bit much for me. But
it's also like, that's literally the thing he's trying to do.
Yeah, right, is, you could put a little lipstick
on
that.
Well, I get what Brian's saying is it verges on targeting President Bush versus making a wider point when you quote so closely like that.
Yes, sure. Yes. But that and the Christian rock concert was just an amazing set piece, right down to when they stole Justin Robert Young's Reverend's, what's his name, James Thurgood.
Sure. I think that's more just a compliment on how good Justin's is. Not
yes, exactly.
Justin
like of what an archetype it is.
Yeah.
But it was so good that I went back and recorded the screen and sent it to Justin, where he's like, bro, bring it in. And then, it's so good.
Since we're going to have internal references here, the fact that the backstage area is the Diamond Club.
Yes. And that happened like 30 seconds after that exact moment. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
Any fans in the production crew? Let us know.
I don't know. How about friend of the show, your friend of mine, Dan Trachtenberg, who directed the pilot episode?
He directed the first episode,
I'm sure he was around people.
Yep.
Oh, you don't think he was around? You think they?
He was around for not his episode?
Yes, right. Because they shoot all that stuff concurrently. They
he might have dropped some hints and some thoughts. Who knows?
Maybe.
Yeah.
What did you guys think about kind of the whole Vought sort of superheroes as a private military contractor plot line?
That just seems like the MacGuffin, and I understand it's to me. This is the story of what if the Avengers were real. And what if we saw their meetings with Disney, who has one obligation, which is to meet the expectations of their shareholders? And what if they are put through the ringer, told at all turns how to manage their brand, and where do they find solace to act out and what must they do?
This is most likely drawn from Marvel Cinematic Universe actual anecdotes that have been kicking around, right? And then you add on that, like, what if Robert Downey Jr. was actually Iron Man? You know, like let's actually like take these stories and make them and amp them up by making the characters who they are. Because a lot of those vignettes just felt like, oh yeah, this is a typical like evil Hollywood trying to act like they're acting in the actor's interests. Except with superheroes.
Did you notice?
And lots of Me Too movement kind of rhetoric being thrown out. Lots of Social Network influencer type rhetoric being thrown out. I mean, it is a movie industry story.
Did you notice that when, and if there's any question about whether this whole thing is just an allegory for Hollywood, only a subtle one, like another movie, when they hand Starlight her first crime to bust, it is a call sheet. That is a standard call sheet template. And so it's like, hey, guys, this is Hollywood. They have a gig and off they go.
No, exactly. And everything is you know, press moments and junkets and, you know, stand ups and things they've got to shoot to improve the image and how many points you've gone up and how many follows you have. Like, that's all carried through. Yeah, absolutely.
I also dug. Also, right on the nose was the Dragon Con Hall of Fame, where
the Walk of Fame. Oh my God, it was so good! Yeah,
like
with Billy Zane
as Billy Zane, yes, and Haley Joel Osment playing a former child star,
right?
That was all so great.
Every piece of that him like. Talking to people, saying the tagline, going to the next photo. So good. Lots of bits and pieces. What did y'all think of the relationship between Huey and Starlight, which is the more tame plot line, albeit the main one, really.
Yeah, I think it was the wholesome enough. It felt like a good anchor. I was rooting for him because he's been put in a rough spot. And then you begin to realize the ramifications of he did just straight up murder her co-worker. Yep. And that is a complicated thing to explain. But then, you know, she has to sort of answer for why she's working for a system that covered up the murder or the accidental manslaughter of her girlfriend. I liked it all. To me, I'm increasingly surprised by how fascinated I am with the tortured soul, the evil tortured soul of the Homelander. And I thought that was a fine way to end season one, where the main plot threads had been figured out. But then they set up like, oh, this is going to be a real thorny thing to fix going forward. Where with just that wolf's grin on Homelander is just chilling.
Yeah. What is he going to do with Billy Butcher? And now that we know she's alive, Billy Butcher's wife and son, who is Homelander's son, not Billy Butcher's son. What are they going to do with the position that Fring had promised to our main corporate person all the way through?
Stillwell. Ms. Stillwell.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they held back Giancarlo Esposito for that long and just gave him a little bit of a moment. You know, I thought what's her name? Ms. Stillwell was just amazing. She was
so good. Yeah.
And I liked her savvy in that very Hollywood, you're great. Oh, your superheroing is just the best. But listen, you gotta stay on message. You think you can do it? You know, all of that stuff was
everything said with a smile.
Yes.
Everything is so right on. And right? Like,
what, one thing they...
So, Brian, we're not going to be doing cord killers anymore. Don't worry. Yeah.
One thing I think they did just the right amount of is, you know, they play with a lot of kind of sexual fetishes. Given what Homelander lacks in his life, it would make sense, his particular obsession. I think that it was thoughtful, whether that's, you know, what you think belongs in the story or not. I do think they put a lot of thought into those angles of things.
Two mysteries in particular I would have liked seen treated in this season, and I assume we might see treated in a future season. One is, why did Lamplighter leave? Right. We get a couple of allusions to him like burning Mallory's children. And so we know that he was not a good guy and he was the vicious person. Is that connected? Did he just retire because he was old? I mean, these guys can't die. So why did he leave? Would have been curious to know more about that. Didn't undermine the story in any way. And the other is the blanket thing. They made a big deal about him being upset about the blanket and him going to the trash and pulling out the blanket. I couldn't tell if I'm just supposed to assume that's a kind of a nebulous like connection to his childhood because they show the flashback him holding the blanket there was something else on top of that.
They very explicitly, they had the whole scene where he's on camera telling the fake story of his fake childhood and a fake home. Yeah. Then they showed the reality and in the reality, he's in that sterile room.
Yeah,
and the only object of comfort, the only true thing from his childhood, the only thing that made him feel safe was that exact physical blanket. So to have that defiled and handled by people and thrown into this fake scene was rage inducing for him.
I guess that's all we need. I still felt like I wanted to know more about the blanket. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Maybe because it was the only thing from his childhood.
Yeah. I will say, I want to give an award to the character that moved in my mind the farthest from what I thought he was upon introduction to what I thought he was at the end, was Frenchie. Frenchie is very clearly a homicidal, mad genius maniac. He is a weapon to be brandished and directed in a certain, you know, he is a soulless mercenary murderer who talks about the exquisite joy of killing a super. And then by the end, he is the emotional anchor for the boys, for the team. He's the one who extends an open heart to the female, as she's called.
Kimiko.
Kimiko, that's right. We get a name later on. But I thought that was pretty remarkable. I like that.
Yeah, he hadn't met the right person yet. Is kind of how I interpreted that. Like, yeah, like he was just unhappy in life, and he thought this was all there was. And then he met Kimiko, and he had something to live for, and it changed his whole perspective. It was really well done. I love that.
I did enjoy the whole Spice Girls thing. That was what a great.
Well, that's one of those little things that I don't know. It felt. I know Seth Rogen is involved with Preacher, and maybe there's some influence on that, but it felt like Preacher, where they just. They'll throw out a thing and you'll be like, that was random. And then they'll tie it in until you're like, that wasn't random at all. That was because his wife used to sing Spice Girls around the house. And I love that. I love that aspect.
Yeah.
Anything else on the boys?
No, highly recommended. Oh, I also quick tip of the hat. The only way this could have really failed hard is if we got a CW level of graphic arts and dramatic pacing or whatever. Like, we're shy of movie level quality, but not far from it. And I think that was really important on the production quality. I thought that was great.
All right, let's move on to Extras, episode 6, season 1, the Picard episode, as I keep calling it, but it's Patrick Stewart. Where when he has the moment where he talks about his film script, which is all about just seeing women's clothes fall off in various situations, I had amazing deja vu. I've either seen that clip or had someone describe it to me before, because I'm like, oh yeah, no, this is I know where he's going. Everything's going to be the women falling clothes off. Still hilarious, and actually not. What makes this episode memorable? What makes this episode memorable is how it deals with racism.
Sorry, homophobia?
Wait, am I confusing last week's episode and this week's episode?
Yes. Last week was the one where she went to go hide the doll got busted. No,
this one has to do with homophobia. You're right. I apologize.
Yeah, but a similar note. I was really amazed at how sweet it got, and how I like how far from the original, format that we got. I like that there was that one dunking on his friend moment because he'd sold a pilot, and he moves into kind of David Brent territory. But then he has a genuine grievance. I was so just wincing at when his friend. Spoke out of turn and then felt justified in him blowing up at her.
Well, because every piece of that is a thing I could see really happening.
Yeah.
And actually a thing I've probably seen an example of happening, right? Maybe not in that chain of events that causes that much of a disruption, but someone being annoyed with someone and then just making an offhand comment that is an exaggerated version of what they really think, right?
Right.
But then the friend thinking they're doing a favor, passing it along in a way that they think is okay, but are not sure. And then the person being polite says it's okay, which makes them think it is okay, but it's not, and causing a big breakdown. That's all stuff that actually happens.
Yeah, it was fun to see Ricky Gervais play the straight man. Like, he plays the straight man in the Picard scene, which was a fun change of pace, but then... we're reminded that, this is, kind of a David Brent character. That one moment when he goes, well, don't worry, he won't be with us very long. And he goes, AIDS? and then doubles down, like, wait, what? You're like, does he have AIDS? Like, that was agonizing.
Well, and the difference between this character and David Brent is David Brent would not have let that go. That would have been another 5-minute bit, right? This character at least backs off, is like, oh, yeah, never mind. Yeah, okay, got it.
I did like that the Patrick Stewart stuff paid off in the phone call when he says, I'm working on a movie and I think you would be fantastic. And then he hangs up. He's like, gotta go buy a click. And I was like, why would he do that? And then I remembered what the movie was and that he respects his friend.
Yeah, it was a... It was lovely to see Patrick Stewart walking around going, have you seen the next Star Trek, The Next Generation? Assuming the answer would be yes and never getting the answer yes.
Yeah, that part when the scene wraps up with him saying, you're not married, you don't have a girlfriend, and you've never seen Star Trek, The Next Generation. And then pause, and he's like, my Lord. Like, or my Lord. I forget what he says, but it was a great punch out.
Yeah, no, it was really good. Honestly, not much else to say about this. It was a solid episode, and I get why this is the one universally praised, because there's great moments throughout.
Yeah, and as the pattern breaker, it's the first one that I think had real heart to it that we hadn't really seen, because we hadn't earned that familiarity with the characters just yet.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. Well, thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us and chatting and spoilering. Pass the word, spread the word, and keep supporting us at patreon.com/cordkillers, and we'll spoil you again next week.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.